Before news.
The news 50 years ago, in October 1956, was dominated by the Hungarian uprising. The revolution was, however, short-lived. It was crushed within a month, and for decades the memory of those weeks was suppressed. Today there are bitter divisions about how 1956 should be remembered and who has the right to mourn the dead. James Moore uncovers Hungary's unfinished business in half an hour. That's after Case Notes with Dr. Mark Porter.
Hello. Allergies, particularly to foods, are a growing problem across the developed world. Here in the UK, they've increased fivefold since the early 80s, and the number of children allergic to peanuts has trebled in the last decade alone. In today's programme, I'll be finding out what it's like to live with a potentially life-threatening allergy. We visit the home of restaurateur Giorgio Locatelli and his wife Plaxi and witness firsthand the challenge of cooking for their daughter Dita.
The main things she's allergic to are nuts, tomatoes, rice, eggs, fruit.
Fish.
All fish. And she can't eat pulses. God, what can you eat, Dita?
And I'll be finding out about a new treatment, oral immunotherapy, that can cure allergies and is widely available on the continent, but which is barely used this side of the channel. But first to the allergy unit at Southampton General Hospital, where paediatric allergist Dr. Jane Lucas has a follow-up appointment with Polly and her mother Beverly.
Hello, Polly. Have you had any problems with accidental episodes with peanuts?
I have my EpiPen with me all the time, and I generally avoid anything, and most food things have the warnings on them, so you can quite easily avoid.
We saw you a few years ago and managed to ascertain that you'd outgrown your egg and milk allergies.
Yeah.
Have you managed to introduce egg and milk into your normal diet now?
Milk I have in my cereal or in chocolate and things.
Great.
Egg I can eat if it's in cooked, so like in cakes or something.
Jane, initially when somebody like Polly comes along to your clinic with a story that suggests that they may be allergic to some foods, how do you go about confirming that?
Well, the first thing to do is to take a good history. We've no perfect test, and so the tests are really a confirmation for what we suspect from what the patient tells us. So, for example, early on, Polly was actually very unwell as a baby when she had the milk, and the tests would have been based on that story.
But people can be upset by milk, but doesn't necessarily mean that they're allergic to it. I'm thinking of intolerances here. What's the difference between those two?
That's right. Allergy's got a very specific meaning medically, and that's that you have an immunological reaction to the food. So there's some interaction between your immune system and the food that you're eating. Usually it's an antibody called IgE, and that's the most common form of allergy, and that's the form of allergy that our tests are based on. So the skin test and the blood test, where we measure IgE in the blood.
Polly, how did you know that you had a problem with allergies in the first place? What was the first sign of trouble?
Well,
shall I step in here? She was very young. She was only a baby when we first discovered that she had allergies. And all the classic symptoms of itchy lips and swollen face. And she would be sick as well if she had, in those days, milk, dairy products and fish, that sort of thing. She gets a funny voice, and she can get a little bit wheezy as well.
Jane, can you explain what's happening during these severe reactions?
The food is causing the immune system to react in an abnormal way, really. The IgE, the antibody to the allergen on the mast cells, cause mast cells to release the granules that are in them.
Mast cells being part of our natural immune defence, and they basically explode.
They explode, releasing all their granules and actually making some other substances as they go along, the most potent of which is histamine, which causes blood vessels to dilate and become leaky, causes your airways to constrict, and so you become wheezy.
Which, of course, is what you want. If something's happened locally, you want your blood to go there. You want all the immune soldiers to line up and be able to escape from the blood vessels. You just don't want it to happen all throughout your body.
Throughout your body is not what you want, and you don't want it happening to foods, because that's a normal part of your life.
This is a nasty invader, but not a peanut.
Absolutely, for parasites.
So they get this potentially catastrophic release of this chemical.
The worst scenario could be a potentially life-threatening event known as anaphylactic shock.
Every parent's nightmare, and one all too familiar to London chef Giorgio Locatelli. In a cruel twist of fate, his daughter Dita is severely allergic to hundreds of different foods, including many of his favourite dishes. Katie Hickman joined Giorgio and his wife Plaxi as they prepared Dita's evening meal.
Okay, so we're going to do first the chocolate cake and then the pasta dita. This is a special chocolate cake, no? Which is eggless. She loves chocolate. Sugar. Get the flour. Okay, then we're going to...
So do you have quite a sweet tooth, Dita?
Yes. You can only buy chocolates because the sweets all have additives and things like that inside, which I'm allergic to.
So your choice is quite limited, but you still have a choice.
Yeah. Galaxy.
Yeah, that's it. Her sundae is like, she gets a galaxy. Okay, you have to mix all that together, Dita.
With a spoon.
Yeah.
Which is...
Spoon. The main thing she's allergic to are nuts, tomatoes, rice, eggs, fruit.
All fruit.
All fruit.
Fish.
All fish. I mean, the list kind of is a bit endless.
She had bad time with some spinach the other time, didn't she?
She can't really eat spinach, and she can't eat pulses.
So what can she eat?
She can eat chicken, beef and pork. She can eat pasta without egg, obviously. I mean, there's like two vegetables she can eat. She can eat green beans, she can eat broccoli, but it doesn't go down very well. God, what can you eat, Dita? It's a minefield, actually. It really, really is. And sometimes you think, oh, we're really safe with that. We know she can have it.
Yeah.
And then she's not okay with it.
Okay, so we're going to put everything together now, Dita. You put in or...
I'll put it in.
Okay. Gently, gently.
Shop bought for her is impossible, which in a way is a good thing, you know, but what worries me is when she goes to secondary school and they all say, well, let's go and have a sandwich, or, I mean, if she goes into any of your standard sandwich shops, they all have egg, they all have tomato.
Are you worried about the cross-contamination, so even if she doesn't have egg, it will be prepared on the surface with
absolutely, egg? Absolutely, absolutely.
And that's enough to cause her...
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, we've only just been able to start cooking rice. If we open all the doors and put all the extractors on, and she has to go out of the room. Oh, so it's not really worth it, you know, it's not... I mean, it has restricted everybody's diet in a way. It's a fairly dramatic impact on your life.
Oh, looks so yummy.
That should be okay.
When did you first realise that she was allergic to the...
When she was a baby. When she had an enormous anaphylactic reaction to salmon, and we had a sort of disastrous rush to a hospital in the middle of France, not knowing how to get there, not knowing how, where we were, not, and she'd swelled up and stopped breathing. And we managed to get to the hospital purely by chance, because we flagged down a passing fire engine. They gave her a shot of adrenaline and antihistamines, and it was like magic. And then it's the real shock of them being told, right, you have to carry... two EpiPens with you everywhere you go, and you have to carry antihistamines, and it's just a complete change of kind of, you know, your whole life.
Since her first anaphylactic shock, has she had many others? Have you... you say you carry two EpiPens. Have you had to use them?
We have, yeah, and we've used them usually... actually, the times we've had to use them is on holiday, when you obviously you're eating out a lot more, and people say, yes, we understand, and they never truly do. Last year was the worst. How many did we use? Four.
What are you doing now?
I'm just going to do some... finish up the pesto with our pine nuts. And I'm going to put some olive oil in there.
How's the school reacted to having the EpiPens in school?
They've been brilliant. They've been absolutely brilliant. But I have to say that we went to see an awful lot of schools who weren't brilliant and who insisted that she have lunch on her own in the headmaster's office when she was 4.5 years old, and treated very differently, and it really was beginning to make her very introvert and very unhappy.
There was someone who died when she went on holiday in our school. How long was it ago?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. She died on holiday from a nut allergy.
She ate some cheese, didn't she? And it had nuts in it.
And it had nuts in it.
And there's so many people... I mean, in her school alone, there's 12 or 15 kids who've got serious nut allergies. I've never heard of it before. I have a son who's 18, and there was never a talk of nut allergy or anything else.
Can I have a go?
Yeah. This is, you know, what she can have as a pasta, because it's got no eggs or anything else. Pasta is always quite a good thing to do with kids. They like it. Yeah. You end up finding some sticky on the ceiling as well after...
The lovely thing about eating together and sharing a meal together is quite difficult for some with allergies.
That is major. It's the major problem, because you can't partake in with everybody else when they go out, and that's children, when she becomes a student, and her friends are going to go for a
kebab.
That would be very difficult for her. It would be almost impossible.
So what's going to happen when she gets older? Do you worry about it? Do you think about
it? I worry about it all the time. And I always think, God, poor kid, she's going to have her mother trailing behind her with bags and thermoses. And I do particularly worry the whole time about when she's older. And I mean, even to the extent, you know, you hear about people who've kissed their boyfriends who've eaten a bag of nuts in the pub an hour before, and they have terrible problems.
So, no boyfriends, Dieter?
Yeah, well, obviously no boyfriends. Straight to the convent in Italy till she's 42, and then, you know, back home to live with Mum, I think.
The pesto was straight, as you saw it, was just the leaves and the olive oil only. And I had a bit of salt at the end, and that's all I did. And this is it. How is it, Dieter?
Well, she's nodding.
She's nodding, yeah. That's good.
Jane, Dieter's obviously got a very serious food allergy. But how common are food allergies now that might cause these potentially serious anaphylactic reactions?
Well, food allergies are actually very common in children. It's probably about 6 to 8% of infants and younger children have allergies.
So as many as, what, 1 in 14, 15, something like that?
Something like that. But because egg and milk allergies usually outgrown, by the time you get to 7 or 8 years of age, it's only maybe 2% of children. There's also evidence that those increasing number of allergies. There's a study from the Isle of Wight from some years ago that showed there was 0.5% of their population had peanut allergy. That's actually increased to near 1.5% within a few years.
Do we know why?
No, we don't know why allergies are becoming more common. What we do know is that they seem to be associated with a Western lifestyle. Some people have put this into an idea called the hygiene hypothesis, which suggests it's something to do with our clean, sanitised lifestyle, so our immune system isn't being challenged to deal with the bacteria and so on. But that's probably a very simplistic approach to it, and we're now looking more deeply into the underlying immunological changes that are happening.
So how do we manage children who've got this level of allergy? Presumably step one is obviously to do what they can to avoid coming into contact with the allergen.
That's right, and it's advice from a dietitian, from the allergy nurse, medical advice, all really aiming on to avoid the foods, but also to make sure that the diet is adequate in other ways.
And what happens if they do accidentally become exposed?
The most important thing is that they need to be able to recognise the severity of it, because the treatment depends on that. So for a mild reaction, we'd advise they would take an antihistamine as soon as possible. Mm.
Just a tablet?
Just a tablet, yep. Which they would need to carry at all times. But for someone having a severe reaction, they need to be injected with adrenaline. And the most common way that that's done, there are preloaded pens that contain a dose of adrenaline. Give the adrenaline and call 999, shout for help.
And the adrenaline works how?
It reverses most of the effects of histamine, so it causes the blood vessels to constrict and it relaxes the airways and the lungs, so it makes breathing easier.
But there are people who question how common serious food allergies actually are. While as many as 1 in 6 parents believe their children have food allergies, one study suggests the real figure is more like 1 in 50. Alan Culver, Professor of Community Child Health at Newcastle University, also believes the dangers posed by such allergies may have been exaggerated.
I conducted a study which looked between 1990 and 2000 at all the deaths in children under 16 in the United Kingdom and Ireland. And I found that there were 8 deaths, so that's slightly under an average of 1 death a year. Now, of course, that 1 death is an absolute tragedy for the family. But nevertheless, that number was, I think, very much smaller than many people had anticipated, and I think even surprised me.
You've questioned the number of EpiPens that are prescribed for children with allergies. Why?
There is no clear evidence that, in fact, EpiPens prevent that very small number of deaths. In those 8 deaths that I mentioned, 2 of them, in fact, the children had received absolutely optimal treatment and still died. So that the idea that by having an EpiPen, therefore everything is all right, is in fact a slightly concerning message to give. The key message to give is that the child should go to hospital as soon as possible. One also knows from some of the studies that, of course, you may be given an EpiPen, but it may be many years before you actually might be called upon to use it. And in those circumstances, the families very often find that, in fact, they are very anxious about giving such an EpiPen. It is, after all, an injection into a muscle, which they have to decide to do. So that a tremendous amount, therefore, of anxiety is created not around just the food allergy, but about the administration of this EpiPen, and that one could move away from much of that anxiety by prescribing fewer, but nevertheless emphasising the crucial point that a child should go to hospital quickly.
Alan's findings there, Jane, suggest that life-threatening reactions and indeed deaths are nowhere near as common as many parents and indeed many doctors might think. Do you think it matters if we're seen to overreact and are giving out too many EpiPens?
Well, I don't think we are overreacting. I think the fact that we've got not many deaths, although we have an increasing number of people with allergies, may reflect the fact that we're educating our parents and children how to avoid the foods and how to manage the situation if it arises. I think it has to be something that's the decision between the doctor and the parents as to whether they feel more anxious carrying it or whether they feel more anxious not to have any treatment to hand.
How do you explain allergies like peanut allergies to parents? Obviously, you want to make them aware enough of the potential risks without blowing them out of all proportion. It's a pretty fine path to tread, isn't
it? There is, and we have no way of knowing who's going to have a severe reaction the next time. And just because you've had a mild reaction one time doesn't mean that you're not going to have a severe reaction the next time. So identifying that risk is actually quite difficult. What we do know is that there are certain foods and certain patient groups that are more at risk. So, for example, people with peanut allergy are at higher risk than some of the other food groups, and people with asthma are at a significantly higher risk of having a severe anaphylactic reaction or even death if they come into contact with the food.
Now, we heard that Polly's grown out of her milk and hopefully her egg allergy. Mm-hmm. Is that common?
It is, actually. It's about 80% of infants who have egg and milk allergy will have outgrown their allergy by the time they go to school. So that's an important reason why children need to be followed up with these allergies.
Because presumably, unless they're retested, they're unlikely to find out that they've grown out. They're not going to go along and try it, are they?
No.
Not any sense.
It would be a dangerous thing for them to do without having a blood test or a skin test to prove that it was safe for them to go ahead and try it. It's much less likely that she'll outgrow her nut allergy. It's probably only about 10, 15, maybe 20% of people outgrow those allergies. But even so, from Polly's point of view, 20% is very high, because if we can undiagnose her, she can stop carrying her EpiPens, life it would become much simpler.
So how are we going to do that?
So what we're going to do first of all is a skin test. We have some solutions which contain an extract of the proteins in the food that she might be allergic to. A drop of that solution is put onto her skin, and then Rosie, who's our allergy nurse sister, will make a small scratch on the skin. If Polly's allergic, we'd expect the skin to come up in a wheel.
Okay, Rosie, over to you. If you want to do the test.
We're going to test you for egg, peanut, mm-hmm. and for the tree nuts, cashew, almond, hazel, walnut and Brazil nut. Mm-hmm. And you've said to me you're not sure whether kiwi fruit also causes you problems, so we've got a fresh kiwi fruit here. We're just going to put by each of the marks on your arm a very small amount of the allergen substance. Because we don't have a solution for the kiwi, we actually have a kiwi fruit here, and we dip the little lancet into the kiwi fruit and take it straight out and just scratch Polly's skin.
Can you feel that, Polly? Does it?
Mm-hmm.
Like a little tiny, minuscule scalpel blade, isn't it? There's no blood yet.
There's no blood. There is no blood. And then we have to wait 15 minutes, so we put the
stopwatch
here.
James, I was interested in your choice of kiwi, because it seems that there are more reports of kiwi allergy.
Yes, I've actually just completed a study of over 400 people with kiwi fruit allergy in the UK, and we found that it does appear to be an allergy that's increasing, and although our previous knowledge was that it seemed to be a very mild allergen, we found that in children with kiwi fruit allergy, a high number of them have anaphylaxis, so severe reactions to the food.
Sorry, if Polly passes this test now, your next stage would be to allow her to eat nuts or...
The skin test nor the blood test are 100% predictive. Mm-hmm. And so the only way to confirm that she would have truly outgrown an allergy would actually be to challenge her, which would involve bringing her into a hospital situation and giving her initially very tiny amounts of food to eat and increasing amounts whilst under medical and nursing observations.
So Polly, the 15 minutes is up, and we'll have a look and see what's happened to your arm. As far as the kiwi fruit's concerned, you do appear to have an allergy to kiwi fruit. It's a wheel which measures 10 millimetres by 5 millimetres. I'm afraid, Polly, you're still are going to have to continue to avoid peanuts. As far as the tree nuts are concerned, the cashew, the almond, the hazel and the walnut have had no reaction to them at all, which would be great. It would mean you could maybe introduce them to your diet, but only after you've had a food challenge. Well done, Polly. I hope your arm isn't too itchy.
Yeah, it looks like you've been. Looks like you've had your arm in some nettles there. Does it feel itchy?
Yeah.
Polly, are you surprised that you've still come up with the peanut, or were you expecting, you were expecting that?
I was expecting that. The risk of peanut is much more than other nuts, so, and it's good to know that I should still be aware of it. Losing my dairy allergy, it's been really useful because I can eat chocolate, and just going out in general has made it a lot easier because I can eat so much more. So I don't, if I go to a restaurant, I don't have to be so aware.
How important is following up children as they grow older with their allergies?
It's absolutely vital, and in fact, there's a great shortage of paediatric allergists and paediatric allergy clinics in this country, which is a big political and social issue. We've got a lot of children on restriction diets that needn't be because of poor follow-up.
Dr. Jane Lucas. And there are serious concerns about cutbacks in specialist allergy services across the whole of the UK, including the unit at Southampton. Stretched at the best of times, cuts are likely to mean that many children in Polly's situation miss out on specialist follow-up and may never know if they're among the lucky ones who grow out of their allergies. Now, while children can grow out of them, adults often grow into allergies. The basic treatment, a combination of allergen avoidance, antihistamines and adrenaline-containing EpiPens, is the same. But there's another approach used in adults that can offer a cure. Immunotherapy, or desensitization, is widely used in the States and many countries in Europe. Dr. Tony Williams is a consultant immunologist at Southampton, one of just a handful of centres offering the treatment in the UK.
The principle is to administer the allergen extract to the individual such that they develop tolerance to that allergen. The best example would be bee and wasp allergy, where we start with 1/5,000th of an eventual sting, and then we eventually work up to 2 stings worth of the allergen in that individual.
We're both allergic to bee venom, and as beekeepers, that can be something of a disadvantage.
Christine and John Stevens came to us, and indeed following a conventional 3-year course of immunotherapy, both have proved a success.
Christine was stung by one bee in the garden picking raspberries, and within 10 minutes she'd gone into a full-scale anaphylactic reaction.
And what did you notice at the time, Christine?
I began to feel peculiar and just really getting to the point of struggling for air. And John came in and took one look at me and decided that the hospital might be a good place to go.
So that was how your allergy to bee venom was detected. What happened in your case?
Well, we continued, with a couple of beehives. Christine took extreme care not to get stung. 2 gloves, 2 veils, 2 sweaters, the whole thing. After a year or more, I had exactly the same reaction, quite suddenly. And Christine wheeled me swiftly down to the hospital.
So since then, you've both undergone immunotherapy. What did that involve?
It involved coming down here every week for, I think, the first 6 or 8 weeks, then every fortnight, and then it gradually spread out to once every 8 weeks over a period of 3 years, where we were given increasing doses of bee venom.
And John, the doses are given as tiny injections?
Tiny injections in alternating arms. The initial injection was a minute amount of bee venom, but still enough to cause a reaction, and we were then monitored for at least 30 minutes just to see how serious that reaction would be. Christine had several almost full-scale allergic reactions. I just made a fuss.
And how effective has it been?
Pretty effective. Certainly to the point where neither of us have had an anaphylactic reaction, although we have been stung since. We still both react a little, but it's completely manageable. We can take an antihistamine and any reaction disappears within about 15 minutes.
So that's all you need is the antihistamine now? You're not injecting yourselves or anything
not
like that?
Not at all, no.
And do you still keep bees?
Yes.
So would you have gone for the desensitization even if you hadn't have been beekeepers?
Definitely.
Yes, we would.
It was driven home to us, actually. One day we were on holiday in France, stopped for a picnic, and a swarm of bees flew by. We were miles from anywhere in the middle of France, and it was that as much as anything that said to us, actually, we need to do something about this, whether or not we continue with beekeeping. And so it's made a huge difference in that sense, because it means that we can live a completely normal life and not be paranoid about the possibility of getting stung by a bee in the garden or on a picnic or anywhere else.
There are a number of suggestions why this treatment works. It may be that the small incremental doses in addition to the other components of the vaccine, are able to change the immune response in a way that's not comparable to a natural exposure of that particular allergen.
And how effective is the treatment?
The efficacy has been estimated to bring about a 40% reduction in medication use and symptom score, typically for the well-studied grass pollen allergy as part of hay fever. If you then turn to allergens such as cat, house dust mite, tree pollens, bee and wasp, generally speaking, you'd hope to help approximately 8 out of 10 people.
Historically, we seem to have lagged a bit behind mainland Europe in using desensitization in certain people. Why is that?
There's a degree of historical background there with regard to immunotherapy being quite well practiced in the late 60s, early 70s, and there was an investigation in the mid-1980s with regard to the safety of immunotherapy, and what was found is that in those treated for severe asthma in particular, a death rate was identified, and over a 25-year period, approximately 26 deaths were attributed to systemic immunotherapy. The key change in the UK was the provision of a national response to the safety concerns, such that the advice for all those in the UK practicing was to administer the immunisations to selected individuals outside of the asthma, with a requirement for 2 hours stay post-immunotherapy within the doctor's office. And those have limited the practicalities of service delivery in a way that wasn't specified across other European healthcare systems.
Last month there were headlines in the newspapers talking about a new pill for treating hay fever. This is an oral type of desensitisation. How does that work, and is it as effective as claimed?
Yeah, these are very exciting times with immunotherapy, because the new emerging immunotherapy include those that can be simply administered under the tongue and then after a period of time swallowed. And that has proved to be, both in paediatric and adult practice, effective and much more safe.
So does that mean that it can be literally taken by the patient at home?
That is the key change that's taking place, that once the tablet has been administered for the first or second dose within the hospital environment, the safety concerns are such that we can now allow individuals to continue their treatments at home. Again, European allergists are probably 5 years ahead of us with regard to their introduction. For example, within France and Italy, approximately half of their mite and pollen allergic individuals are on the tablet immunotherapy, where the fraction in the UK is incredibly small and at the moment is probably restricted to clinical trials.
That's a remarkable difference.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. The change that may happen in the UK if sublingual immunotherapy is taken on board are quite considerable.
Dr. Tony Williams on an exciting new development in allergy treatment yet to establish itself here in the UK. If you want to listen to the programme again, or if you want the recipe for Giorgio Locatelli's delicious eggless chocolate cake, then do log on to the website. That's bbc.co.uk/radio4. Next week's programme is all about the interface between art and medicine, how hospitals are using music to improve health and speed up recovery.
Case Notes was presented by Dr. Mark Porter, and the producer was Katie Hickman. And if you have a question about tonight's programme, you can also call the Radio 4 Action Line. The number is 0800 044 044. That's 0800 044 044. Next tonight, uncovering the secrets and lies surrounding Hungary's failed uprising against Soviet rule in 1956. And then at 10, we'll be catching up on all today's main news with the world tonight. Here's Robin Lustig.
Thank you, Cathy. Well, in tonight's programme, what the Romanians and the Bulgarians think of Britain's decision to restrict how many of them can come here once they've joined the EU. Will the restrictions make any real difference? Are Cameron's Conservatives really conservative? We'll be debating where the party is headed. We'll also be asking if France is ready for a female president and why French troops are alleged to have played an inglorious role in the Rwandan genocide atrocities of 12 years ago. Join me for the world tonight. In half an hour.
Thanks very much, Robin. Well, before that, on BBC Radio 4, Hungary's unfinished business. In the weeks leading up to the 50th anniversary of the Hungarian uprising, James Moore has travelled to Budapest to find out how 1956 is remembered today. He'll meet teachers, tour guides and Hungary's Prime Minister. But his journey begins at an anti-government protest.
The demonstration started quite spontaneously yesterday evening outside the Parliament building. There was about 1,500 people then. But now, 9 o'clock in the evening after dark, there's been a downpour of rain.